It's Doug Fry, Reel 9. Now, we got to the point, we just had talked about your landing and when you were taken to the house.
Yes.
Into the house. What happened next? Take up the story, perhaps from right where it's most comfortable for you to
From the house, yes. Well, having been sat down in the what appeared to be the kitchen of this little house, and my clothing loosened and my wound exposed, and having been given a cup of water by the lady of the house, who had made signs for me not to drink it, but just to wash my mouth out, two young men then came in, and they had tin hats on, so I assumed that they were air raid wardens, and they had a stretcher, which they gently put me on and took me outside into the street, a few yards up from the house, put me on the pavement, and then knocked at the door of the house, which turned out to be the doctor's house. He came out, put a pad on my wound, gave me some sort of an injection, and then I was stood up and I was put in the back of his car, and we merely drove off into the night. I kept losing consciousness, and then, as far as I can recall, falling off the seat, but then getting back on. And eventually, I woke up, and it was daylight. We were driving into the outskirts of either a village or a small town. The street was deserted, but in the distance, I could still see the inevitable chap in a black uniform. That seemed to be everywhere in Germany at that time, and we stopped outside this house, and there were steps coming up straight from the pavement into the front door of this house. I got out of the car, the doctor helped me out of the car into this house, and I saw there was an empty hallway, and against the wall there was a stretcher, and there was a lady there. She had glasses on, I can remember, and she had fair hair swept back in a bun, and they put me on the stretcher, and she leant over me and held out a cigarette to me, and I just nodded my head, since I didn't smoke anyway, and then I passed out again, and I didn't come to until there was a movement of the stretcher and I was being carried outside the house down the steps, and there was an ambulance waiting there. And the back door to the ambulance was open, and I was put onto the bottom shelf of the ambulance. And that was when I heard this voice with a Canadian twang, and it was I recognised in fact as my rear gunner, who obviously had also been wounded, although I didn't know at the time we'd bailed out.
And his name was?
Ken Banks. His flying officer, Ken Banks. He was our rear gunner. And he, in fact, had from the same shell burst, he had had about three pieces of flak through his leg, but fortunately they missed the bone and had gone straight through. Anyway, I then again passed out, and I didn't come to again until we must have been going through, I think it was Dusseldorf, because there was an open window in the ambulance, and through it I could see the tops of bombed out buildings. And then I was gone again. I kept passing out. And the next I knew was I was being carried into this. It was now dark. And I was being carried into this room, brightly lit room, and put on the table, which turned out to be the operating table with the usual big light over it. Across the way, which seemed to me an awful long way away, there was another figure on another table, and he looked about 2 inches long. It was incredible feeling to see. He looked as though he was miles away, but in fact it turned out to be only a few feet between these two tables, and of course this other bod was the Muslim rear gunner. So the I was lying on this table, I was being undressed. And then a chap leant over me and asked me by sign language if I had false teeth. So I shook my head, no. And then a pad came down over my nose and mouth, and I was gone. And then that was it then. And I didn't wake up. I don't know how long it was. It may have been the next day. But I was woken up by people removing this tremendous dressing all around me. And it was stained dark with blood, completely stained with blood. And I had the smell of dried blood in my nostrils. They were cutting this dressing away. Then I passed out again. So I had no recollection of anything apart from that. And I was unconscious for maybe 2, maybe 3 days. I really don't know. And nobody ever told me. But it was some period. And I eventually came to again, and I had this tremendous pain, which I tried to line up in my delirium with. At the end of this this bunk, there was a pole at one end, and on it was hanging a bottle with a drip feed going into my back passage, and the tube was held on with a sticking plaster. And I tried, in my delirium, I was trying to get my pain lined up with this pole all the time. And of course, it was most uncomfortable. It was very hot. It was now August. It was very hot. And the palliasse I was sleeping on, there was a tear in it. And it was merely filled with sawdust and wood chips. And some of this stuff was bursting out. So it was a very uncomfortable bed. And then I moved my head and I felt wet. And my ear was bleeding. So somehow or other, my ear had also been cut. I don't think it had been hit with flak. It had been cut probably when I bowed out. So the movement on the pillow had made it bleed. So once more I was passing out and intermittent coming to and a bit delirious and so on. However, eventually all this passed, and the dressings were changed again, and there was a big drainage tube that they put inside me. So they were fiddling about with that. I remember this was an enormous tube with a safety pin on it so that it didn't slip right inside, to stop it slipping right inside. And the chap who was putting a new dressing on, for some peculiar reason, shortened it and cut a bit off and pulled it out slightly. So they had their own method of doing things, obviously. So then I began to feel a bit better, and the pain subsided. And first chap that came over to see me was my rear gunner. He was quite fit now. His leg wound had healed up quite quickly. And he came over to see me, and he had a card, and he said, "I'll write a card home for you," because I hadn't known at the time. I'd also been hit in the wrist. And they'd put a... when I eventually came to and was feeling a lot better, I found that there was a wireframe. My hand was on a wire frame, so I couldn't have written anyway. So he wrote this card home for me, Ken Banks. And then my next visitor was an American officer who came in on crutches. He'd had both his feet blown off when he was shot down. So they were my first two visitors. And then the third visitor was a Yugoslav, smartly dressed, with his cap on and so on. And he stood by my bedside, clicked his heels, and he handed me a Red Cross parcel, which was an incredible sort of act of comradeship, if you like. And so that was that. So
now, how bad had you been? I mean, because
I'd been very bad, and it must have been touch and go, because I think my problem had been internal bleeding, because there was they put also a frame over me with an ice bag hanging from it. So presumably that was to help the healing process or to stop the bleeding. And then there was a little Frenchman, Andre, his name was. I don't know what he actually did. He wasn't really a medical orderly, but he lived in this other room. And he used to, apparently, I learned afterwards from the other chaps there, that he used to hold vigil over me a couple of times a day. And then he would come back, and they'd ask how I was, and he used to make a sign, waving his hand from side to side, and much as to say it was touch and go. So I was definitely in some sort of problem there. medical wise. However, we did finally recover, and the French orderly came in. But before I really recovered, every night I was having the injection. I think it was morphine to try and get some sleep. But this never seemed to work, so I never did really get any sleep. I was in this constant pain. And then it subsided, and then I was starting to feel better. And then one of the French orderlies came in and gave me a wash. Well, sort of wash, a little bowl of cold water, and a rather grey-looking flannel. And a bit of soap, strange soap, smelt a bit gritty it was, and it smelt horrible. And I found out later, to my horror, that this soap was the stuff that they made from the poor souls that had been burnt in the concentration camps, the fat from the people that they burnt. And it was quite horrible, really. It was horrible smelling stuff, and it was gritty. However, that was my wash, and then I had my first food, which was the end crust of a bit of white bread and a cup of mint tea. The mint tea, I brought up immediately. It was horrible, and I don't like some minty flavours now because of the memories of that horrible taste that made me sick. So that was my first sort of outing, if you like, after I was recovering from my wounds.
Now, what about the removing of the bandages? Because that must have been quite a
well.
Ordeal.
Then the one of the orderlies came in, and at that time a young Yugoslav chap came into the room, and he was there to have his appendix out. This I will explain that this. Stalag 6J was what the Germans called a reserve hospital, and it was really...
That's where you were. Where was it?
Yes, that was about 3 kilometres outside Dusseldorf, a place called Gerresheim, Gerrsheim, I think that is. And it was really for the foreign workers in the Ruhr factories, either if they were sick or had industrial injuries. But they'd started to bring Allied airmen there not long before I was taken there. So that was this chap came in, this orderly, this French orderly, and he had a word with this young Yugoslav chap who was there to have his appendix out. And this Yugoslav fellow, he came over to me, and of course he didn't speak English. But he smiled and he took my hand, and I wondered what was going to happen. And this French orderly, he came over and he had a kidney basin which he was holding there, and he took the dressing off my wound and started to pull the gauze out from the hole
in his stomach.
So that obviously it occurred to me immediately that they'd stuffed me full of gauze because of the internal bleeding. So they were pulling this stuff out yard by yard, and it felt as though my innards were being pulled out as well. But eventually it all ended, and this young Yugoslav smiled at me and squeezed my hands. And that, I thought, was a wonderful thing to do, by way of reassuring me that everything was all right, and in the event that I was having this discomfort. And I thought that was jolly good. So... That's that. The gauze was out. I was obviously healing nicely. The tube was taken out, and the tube that was feeding me was taken out. They connected another tube up to the bottle with a great big needle, and what was left in the bottle, they let go straight into a vein. And I just felt this warm feeling come around as all this stuff went through, and that was that. So and then I was taken out of that room. And on the way out, on a stretcher, and on the way out, they put me into the room where obviously this X-ray equipment was. And I've never really been able to fathom it out, but they laid me on this metal table, a perforated metal table. There was no sort of equipment was brought over, but nevertheless, the doctor who I had the Polish doctor, incidentally, whose name was Captain Polakowski, P-O-L-A-K-O-W-S-K-I, and he just jabbed a finger at my left side and said, oh, there it is, because his English was very good. And obviously they had failed in their search for the flak when they had opened me up, and it had gone, the reason being that it had hit me from the side and gone straight through and came to rest on the left-hand side, where he thought it hit me from the front and operated accordingly. However, so I said, look, you're not going to cut me open again, are you? Well, I didn't fancy that. He said, no, we'll leave it where it is if it's not doing any harm. So that was that. So I continued on my journey on the stretcher to this other room where my rear gunner was. There was a pilot, Pete Andrews, who had been shot down a few weeks previously. He had a broken leg. He was in bed with his leg in plaster, of course. And then there were two Americans. One, Chuck Johnson, who had a broken pelvis. He was on the way to recovery. But the other chap, a chap named Luke Wilson, he'd been shot down over Holland. He'd been in the hospital there, and he had his left elbow shattered, and it was up on a frame at right angles. And he was in a terrible state. And when I went into the room, the other chap warned me, said, for heaven's sake, don't talk to him because he's in a terrible state. And he's a real moaner. And he thinks he doesn't eat anything. Well, there wasn't much to eat anyway, but he wasn't eating anything at all. He looked quite emaciated sitting on his bunk all day. And he kept sniffing his wound because he thought he had gangrene. And his spirit had really gone. It's sad, really. So I don't know what happened to those two Americans. But Chuck Johnson was a cheerful Southern chap from Southern America, and he was quite a cheerful chap, and we got on very well. So that was that. And then little Andre also lived in the room. I call him an orderly, but he didn't seem to do much. He just potted about all day. And then, whilst I was there, another Canadian arrived, also from Holland. He had had his foot amputated when he'd lost his foot when he bowed out. So there were the two Canadians, myself, Pete Andrews, and the two Americans in there, plus little Andre, the Frenchman, in this particular room. We didn't have much to eat, of course. There was Red Cross food there, but we weren't issued with the parcels individually. And I was healing up quite well. I just had a small dressing on my wound by this time. And there came a time when they said, right, you're fit enough to go. That was...
Now, when would that be, roughly, in months? I mean,
I was...
You were there August...
Well, I was there, taken there on the 31st of July, or you could say possibly the 1st of August, because it was sometime around about that period. I don't know exactly. And we were moved out on the 9th of September. And that was Ken Banks. We got our clothes back. Ken Banks, my rear gunner, the one-footed Canadian, and myself. And we got our clothes back and were told to get ready to move out. So the two guards, there were two guards, they came and collected us.
You had some Russian orderlies. Do you want to mention?
Oh, there were lots of Russians in this camp. We didn't see them. They were in a different part of the camp. But outside our room, all day long, there was this Russian, quite a young chap, Nikolai, we called him. And when I went into this room, old Pete Andrews said to me, Nikolai there, he said, if you want anything, just call out Nikolai. If you want some water, just call out Nikolai Vasa. And he's waiting all the time to come in and do something for you, obviously because he wanted to earn himself a cigarette or some food even. So Nikolai, who looked like a tramp, poor quality uniform, very ragged, because they were treated abominably by the Germans, the Russian POWs. So he would come in, if you just call his name out, and he'd come running and see what you want, and he'd get his Red Cross cigarette. So that was another little incident that used to go on there. So thus we were.
You were coming to the point where you were going to move out, yeah.
Yes. So came that time, they'd taken my flying boots away because they weren't. They'd taken my flying boots off when I was on the stretcher in the village. And on the left flying boot had been burst open at the heel, so I think a bit of flak had hit me in the heel, but fortunately the flying boot was strong enough to have held it, but all the silk and the sheepskin was hanging out of the heel in that flying boot. So I never got my flying boots back. I got everything else back of my clothing, but not the flying boots, including my leather jacket, my Irving flying jacket. So
Now, I've just spotted some. So these that come in from notes are quite difficult to read in places.
Yeah.
But there was also an RAF raid before you left that.
Oh, place. Yes.
Do you want to do that before you?
Yes, okay, yes. It came one evening after I've been in this room a couple of weeks, possibly a few days. One night, it was a warm night. It was overcast, but very warm. The window, Pete Andrews' bunk was right by the window and under the window. And the window was open because it was warm. And Pete looked out the window and he said, look, there's a red glow coming through the clouds and a red marker was coming down, obviously a PFF marker. So we thought we were in for it now. We hadn't heard any aircraft, but this was definitely one of our markers, sky marker coming down. And then we started to hear the aircraft going over, and then we heard the explosions, and there were a few. We learned later, of course, we all died to the floor, thinking that we were going to be the target, or at least Dusseldorf. In the event, it was a poor raid, very well scattered because of the weather, apparently. And a few bombs did fall on Dusseldorf, but I think the main target was Leverkusen in the Ruhr. But I learned later that it wasn't a very good raid, as I say, because it was dispersed owing to the weather. So that was a rather frightening incident. We could hear some bombs coming down, and I think there must have been some cookies amongst them, because they made the most peculiar, strange sound. These cookies, instead of the normal whistling that a bomb would make, they made a sort of a tumbling.
What do you mean by cookies?
£4,000 bombs. And so that was rather a frightening episode.
Did any bombs land actually near the camp?
No, there were a few dropped at Dusseldorf, which was 3 kilometres away. But somebody did say that some incendiaries had fallen in the vicinity of the camp. But I couldn't swear to that, because it was just that somebody had said. Now, however...
Where were you going in September then? September the 9th, you said?
September the 9th, we were off. We knew about Dulagluft anyway, which was the transit and interrogation camp. So we knew we were going off to Dusseldorf in Frankfurt. To Dulagluft in Frankfurt. And so the two armed guards took us down to the bus stop outside the camp. That took us down, the bus took us down to Dusseldorf. We got a train at Dusseldorf to Cologne. We changed at Cologne. There were just the three of us and our two guards. We changed at Cologne onto the train, and then of course the railway line runs almost parallel with the Rhine, right through from Frankfurt, and from the station at Cologne station, you can actually see Cologne Cathedral, which was in fact one of the raids I did on Cologne was in fact the aiming point, and the street, you could see the rubble piled in the streets around the station at Cologne. So they'd had quite a bashing, of course, up to that point. So we were now on the train. The train was uncomfortable. I suppose it was third class because they were slatted wooden seats. Very uncomfortable. And so we shared a compartment with the two guards, us three and the two guards. And then the train, off we went along the Rhine Valley. Beautiful along there, that time of year. And we got to Koblenz, and we changed trains at Koblenz. And then we continued on our way to Frankfurt. At Frankfurt, they took us up into a big room that was over the station, and this was filled with shot down RAF airmen, who were also being collected over a period of a few days, I suppose. And heavily bandaged, and there was a rather smell of scorched cloth and dressings, medical dressings in there. And there was quite a lot of chaps in there. It was fitted out with two-tier bunks. So we spent the night there. And next morning we were rousted out, downstairs, into the street, and onto streetcars. With a few hisses and boos from the local population, and we shared the streetcars with in fact the civilians, and the streetcar took us out of the city and into the suburbs, a short distance into the suburbs of Frankfurt, and we got out at a place called Homark. And there we split up. We were sent, all those that had been injured or were still recovering from injuries and so on, one side, and all those that were fit, the other. So all those that were fit went straight to Dulag Luft for to the cell. They used to go into the cells there, of course, and then get interrogated.
Did you do that?
No. Since I was recovering from wounds, I was put with the three or four other chaps that went into Homark Sanatorium, this huge hospital in its own grounds, and there